Well, thank you, Paula, for that wonderfully warm and really generous introduction of all the panelists here today. And congratulations to CETA again for an extraordinary success with the turnout at today's event. And a good afternoon to all of you. It's a great pleasure to be here. Paula invited me to provide some initial comments and remarks in response to the minister's exceptional address. And doing that, I would then also like to invite my fellow panelists to provide some initial remarks as well and responses to the minister's address. But can I start by congratulating Minister Tinley for leading the development of this strategy as first shadow minister and now as Minister for Asian Engagement. I have to say that it is rare to find continuity in the Australian political context at the federal or state level. And Minister Tinley, for you to have led this agenda now for 4 years so wholeheartedly and passionately is a great achievement and a testament to your commitment. So congratulations. Secondly, can I also congratulate you on the development of a measured whole of government strategy that recognizes the need for diversification, as you articulated so well, from traditional industries as a complement and not as a substitute. And then finally, can I also congratulate you on balancing strategy with a focus on capabilities. There is an indisputable correlation between Asia capabilities and firm industry and economic performance. Our research at AsiaLink Business has highlighted that embedding Asia capabilities in the Australian workforce can lift national economic performance by up to $275 billion over the next 10-year period. So there's tremendous upside potential here in Western Australia and having the right capabilities at an individual and organizational level. I'd like to offer 4 ideas to consider as the Western Australian government implements the strategy with its proposed market-specific plans. First, Minister, I encourage your government to build on your ambitious agenda and to set really ambitious targets. I've always been taught that strategy without numbers is poetry, and Minister, you don't strike me as a poet. For instance, with tourism, Western Australia accounts for approximately 5% of Chinese travelers. Growing this to 100,000 from the current 61,000 is more than achievable, but 200,000, I will say, is truly viable if, in addition to policy settings, the WA government enables its key tourism assets to play what we call China host effectively. You could study, for example, the success in the Great South Coast of Victoria, where they recently studied Chinese visitor preferences and customized the products and services of their tourism sector businesses on the Great South Coast, which is where the Great Ocean Road is. This has grown their inbound Chinese visitor numbers, and I would say word of mouth and social listening, which is so important in the Chinese context, suggests that there is a spillover benefit now to other tourism hotspots in Victoria. And in my opinion, Western Australia has more exceptional tourism assets than any other part of the country, so there's absolutely unlimited potential for growth there. Second, the WA government should ensure that country market plans, when focused on sectoral opportunities, consider global competition. Too often in Australia, we get caught up in competing with the other states, but the competition is often global. For instance, in international education, competition could really come from Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Toronto, or London, all hotbeds for great universities and colleges, offering the great combination of academic experience, student experience, and employability. And we really need to, in Western Australia, benchmark against them in attracting Asian students, because that's where the most aspirational Asian students go. One strategic asset to leverage is the city of Perth. Cities control the student experience as much as universities do. So a strong tripartite partnership between universities, the city, and the state government is crucial. Third, we need to align brand WA with the national brand. We have a really unique opportunity at this moment in time. We have an Austrade-led project underway, which for the first time is truly cross-sector and national with its approach. We need to align because we are too small a nation to compete with each other. It also confuses international businesses and investors. Brand WA will only be strengthened by alignment. The national brand project is led by a great Australian and Western Australian, Andrew Forrest. So I can absolutely assure you that any alignment will only lead to significant benefit for this great state. Finally, I'm also delighted to see the focus in your strategy, Minister, beyond traditional trade and investment to also include digital trade. The future for Australia will involve many of our great brands in value-added food, in cosmetics, nutraceuticals, health supplements, and other fast-moving consumer good categories being sold through omni-channel strategies into Asian markets. A deep and nuanced understanding of policy, customs and tax policy, payment systems, logistics implications across e-commerce platforms in the region will be crucial. So I really look forward to discussing these four ideas and others over the course of this panel discussion. But with that, can I invite my fellow panelists now to also share their initial responses to the strategy? And I'd like to start by first inviting Kate Longhurst, who's the State Director with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade here in Western Australia, to provide a perspective from the federal government.
Sure, Kate. Thank you very much, and hello everyone. I really have three main points just to kick off the discussion today. The first is that this is a team sport. As the Australian government's 2017 foreign policy white paper made clear, an open Australia that is engaged with our region is essential for Australia's future security and prosperity. This is our big task. And the reality is that it's going to take effort from the federal government, the state government, and local governments, and all of you. So what we know is that strategies like the one launched today that help this state be better engaged with the Asian region help all of us to achieve that objective. We can see the alignment, including in the strategy's emphasis on capability building. That objective was at the core of the Australian government's launch of the new Colombo plan, which over the last five or so years has allowed almost 4,000 West Australians to study or undertake internships in the Indo-Pacific. It's a wonderful program, and I'm really delighted that there's actually some alumni from the program joining us in the audience today. But you're also, as I said, all members of that team as well. So as the Minister said, members of the diaspora, community, business, sporting organisations, cultural groups, you're part of that team too, and you're all part of the effort. Secondly, I'd just say that I think, to continue the metaphor and relatedly, we need to make sure that we make full use of our full bench. And by that, I mean that I think it's really important that Western Australia fully leverages all Commonwealth efforts. So as a proud West Australian, I think I feel very passionately about ensuring that Western Australians understand and contribute to federal efforts. I think you are extremely well supported by JETSI and by trade commissioners overseas, but don't forget that Australia's overseas network, ambassadors, consuls general, high commissioners, are also representing you and are seeking opportunities and open to opportunities to amplify your efforts and to help take forward our collective objectives. That is also the case with respect to business here in Western Australia. I want West Australian business to be utilising the services of AusTrade, the Trade Start Network, to be using the export marketing development grants, to be thinking about how they can contribute to developing Australia's trade negotiating positions, utilising the IASEPA opportunities. So I would just put in your mind that I think, you know, we see it in terms of small grants funding for sort of smaller, sometimes cultural or sporting opportunities that, frankly, I don't see West Australians as represented in as recipients of those grants. I think certainly there's a work for government to do to ensure that everybody is aware of those opportunities. I'll keep working on that, but I would ask for your help to make sure that West Australians are represented as they should be. And thirdly, I would just say to reinforce the point, this is a rough, competitive sport. So everybody is doing this. So as we think about the optimism and the opportunities that are presented by the Asian region, we are right to feel positive about what WA can offer and how we can contribute. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that not only other states, but other countries are also thinking very actively and very strategically about this region. So I would just encourage everybody to stay alert to those opportunities, not to leave the capability question to our young people. As the Minister said, take advantage, read the Perth US Asia Centre reports, come to CEDAR events. I think we all need to lift our thinking a little bit to really think about developments across the region. If you think there's an opening in Thailand that might present a market opportunity, there's also potentially capability being built in Vietnam and India to deliver on that opportunity. So I just really strongly encourage people to take a broad look and to think deeply about developments across the region. But again, I think we're all working in the same direction. I really look forward to continuing to work with the state government as well as all of you to help us enhance the state's engagement with the region.
Thank you, Kate. Matthew, can I invite you to provide some initial remarks as well?
Yeah, thank you, Mukund. From a business point of view, I think we're very thankful for the vision that the Minister's outlined today and the energy with which he's presented it. The businesses I'm involved in, both foreign exchange and trade, we see already a large percentage of our business heading towards Asia. And so we do actually see something that I think has resonated mostly with myself out of the strategy is we do see signs of that Asian literacy and capability. And I can point to lots of anecdotes amongst our client base and the business people of Western Australia, where they've developed deep understanding of Asia and the cultural ways to progress business in the most appropriate way. And that's been built over 20 years. And also, you know, I'm seeing more and more, in fact, some of my colleagues in the marketplace here today, I'm aware that they have, for the last 2 years, been taking weekly Mandarin lessons as part of their business development plans. But I guess the observation I would like to make is that it's probably not broad-based enough. And I think with the release of this strategy today, that it can get in the mindset of WA business to actually that we all need to come up to speed with a level of literacy that actually develops relationships and understanding what is required to make our Asian counterparts breed trust in what we deliver in a business relationship perspective. I was aware recently of some US State Department data on language that suggested that some of the Asian languages are referred to, I believe, as level one relationships, level one languages. To achieve literacy takes something like 2,600 hours versus a Latin-based language that might only take 600 hours of learning. So there is a real commitment to actually develop those language capabilities. But my observation is that English is often going to be the language of transaction, but it's more a case of having sufficient language capability to actually connect from a relationship perspective. It's almost civility, respect, politeness that we need that broad-based language skills would be my observation. So that certainly resonated, and the last point around the, which I'm sure we'll circle back to, is around the government releasing the Access Asia business grants. Mm-hmm. Very important.
Thank you, Matthew. Jennifer, I'll bring you into the discussion. You're keen to hear your views as
sure.
The Deputy Director General.
Yes, thank you. And I think as the Minister has pointed out very, very clearly, that the strategy really provides a very clear way forward, a direction for how we deepen our connections and engagement with Asia, but also ensuring that the state is well positioned to take advantage of the opportunities that are presented in the region. I mean, our role in terms of the Department of Jobs, Tourism, Science and Innovation, so we'll be responsible for taking the strategy forward, activating it and implementing it in line with those four key themes that have been referred to that are so important in terms of underpinning the success of the strategy. So how we maximise the trade and investment opportunities in the region, how we build Asia literacy and capability within the state, how we really build and develop those people-to-people links to underpin a more relationship-based approach to the region that goes beyond a transactional approach, and also how we support business and the wider community in this engagement. It is very much a collective effort, and you'll see that as a theme running right through the strategy. So in terms of trade and investment opportunities, they've been, I think, outlined very well in the strategy. And they really are coming out of, I guess, what's happening across the region, the major transformation that we are seeing right across the region. We've talked about rapid economic growth, the growth projections going forward, urbanisation, the growth in the middle and consumer classes, the rapid take-up across the region in the digital economy. I mean, these are all really significant trends, and each of them gives rise to a range of opportunities. And you do also see themes emerging across the region that are quite common. And having just come back from 2 years in Indonesia, it really is interesting to go up there and I guess really sort of listen and be attuned to the agenda up there. I think that's a really key point, that when we are looking at accessing opportunities in the region, that we take that market by market approach, but really take that time to understand, you know, what are the social, political, economic drivers within each of the market, and then what we have to offer as a state that really aligns with and actually supports that agenda in each market. So this significant focus across the region, you'll see around upskilling the workforce across the region so that young people, which is a huge demographic across the region, are able to find meaningful employment. Huge focus on innovation and startups, so the opportunities to partner in digital solutions and even in areas like agribusiness and food, you know, what the consumer growth in the consumer class means in terms of those more premium products that we produce. So there's a lot of opportunities and demand that align really well with the state's strengths and capabilities in those priority sectors. And I think that's a key point to make. There is a good alignment between what is needed and what we have to offer. And really it's about being strategic and targeted in our approach. And I think the other themes and pillars within the strategy pick up the need for that. The literacy, the people-to-people links all will underpin our success in that way. So look, our role will be to implement going forward, and we'll be certainly talking about and implementing and looking at how we develop more market-specific plans, very much tapping into a significant resource that the state has in its network of overseas offices. And I should mention that we have two of our commissioners in the room today, John Catlin, who is our commissioner in Singapore, and Stuart Crockett, who is our commissioner in Shanghai. So the state has this great network of offices overseas, mm-hmm. which we will be working very closely with to develop and implement the strategy forward.
Thanks for sharing that, Jennifer, and I encourage everyone to meet with John and Stuart as well, given the opportunity presented with them being here in Perth over the next few days. Can I invite Tia to provide some initial remarks?
Thanks, Mukun. Or should I say terima kasih, Mukun? So I read the strategy with great interest, and I think it's definitely a push in the right direction. So congratulations, Minister, and the team. The panel have discussed some great, themes and topics, and I think the priority pillars define in the strategy are definitely very, very well thought of. And while we do need to focus on, you know, trade and investment to boost our economy, I think, you know, young people also need to be in the forefront of the strategy. After all, we are going to be the future leaders and we are going to be the ones in charge of the trade, the investment and the economy of WA and Greater Australia. In the strategy, we'll read that in 2016 alone, the population of Australian Asians actually contributed to 10% of Australia's total population. And as you can imagine, that's going to increase exponentially as the years go on. I myself was born in Jakarta, but my family decided to migrate to Perth for, you know, for having a better life and an upbringing. And I would say a lot of my peers who are international students coming from an Asian background have loved Perth because it's not a Melbourne, it's not a Sydney. Mm-hmm. Perth has beautiful flora, fauna, nature. It's welcoming and laid back people. I came here in year two and my English was just barely passable, but I found that my classmates was just so magnanimous and generous and contributing to their time during recess, lunch, even after school, to teach me English, to teach me the Australian slang, introduce me what Vegemite was. And I must say, you know, that friendliness has just kept going on in my life and in my, you know, childhood growing up here. And I would say us as West Australians, we've got that advantage, you know. We don't need to be another concrete jungle. And I think that's what's attractive to us as a great place to live. And that's what's really attracting Asians to come over here. I would say, you know, in 2017, $6 billion was contributed into Australia's economy just from international education alone. And out of the Asian population that have come to Australia and decide to live here for over 25 years, that, you know, the population's growing into about 24%. So as time goes on, a lot of people are seeing that there's great benefits in coming to Australia, both for living, also studying, but also for working. And that trend is increasing. So I would say this strategy is definitely going to the right direction. You know, the world is changing so rapidly and us as young people, we need to continue developing a global mindset. From the poll that was, you know, contributed out of the four different pillars and people were asked, you know, which one is the most likely to succeed. It's funny to see that Asian literacy and capability is the lowest, has the lowest chance of succeeding. And I think that's a great way for us to, you know, really reflect on that's definitely a key priority we need to focus on. So, yeah.
And that's a great point, Thea. I might actually pick up on that point in my first question to the panel. Matthew, keen to hear your views, building on your comments on language and the importance of understanding and being able to speak fluently an Asian language, depending upon the context. But for time-poor executives who have not been able to learn an Asian language, they still need to know how to adapt their behaviors to engage in different cross-cultural contexts. From your experience working with the businesses that are engaging extensively with Asian markets, how do you see them without language capabilities going about negotiating and influencing their counterparts from China, India, South Korea, and other markets?
My view would be that what I've observed is that having fluency in language, as I mentioned earlier, is not necessarily the key thing, because to our Anglo embarrassment, I think we've got poor, you know, we're shown up for the high level of English that our Asian counterparts bring to us. And so English continues to be very much the transacting language. So I think it's a function of how do you build respect and how do you build a shared sense of camaraderie without actually showing some interest in the actual language of the counterparty. So that's where I think, you know, it might be too big a stretch to actually expect full understanding, but it's not dissimilar to taking a European trip and being able to have the civilities in the foreign country, you know, in the foreign language, it makes a big difference. I actually think that the it's the cultural awareness of what is appropriate and what's inappropriate. Just by way of negotiation, price negotiation, I often notice that my Asian customers do not have the same sense of win-win unless they feel like they've had some sort of discount to the price, as opposed to what might be considered a normal price discussion locally, where it's first price, best price. And that awareness needs to be worked through.
And that's a great point there, Matthew. Certainly in the work that we've undertaken, we've found that Australians tend to think of ourselves as being exceptionally rational and logical with the way in which we reach a price point in a commercial proposition. But for our counterparts from China, India, Japan, and South Korea, the multi-stage negotiation is the only way for them to assess about whether we are as rational and trustworthy as we think we are. So it's often not a case, I find, of them actually wanting to waste our time or trying to cheat us into a better deal, but how do they know without a multi-stage negotiation that the offer made is actually the best representation of value for them? Tia, I'd like to bring you into the discussion. I was delighted that you made the point around global mindset, which links very well to Matthew's point on cultural awareness. How would you recommend that those entering the workforce can go about building cultural awareness?
Yeah, it's a very good question. When we enter the workforce, we always, think, employers are looking for a great mix of IQ and EQ. I was actually reading, Harvard Business Review, there is a new Q, it's called CQ, which is cultural quotient, and how to be culturally smart. And I think CQ is now this, new essential value add in a person that would increase their employability in the society that is slowly developing into one world. We're so connected across the world now. We don't have to just be Perth. We need to, continue having that global mindset. So, there was an article on Forbes just this year in April that says CQ is now a core essential for success in 21st century businesses and beyond. So I would say, for our young people, regardless if they're Asian, Australian, even in the US, anywhere, we need to, foster that learning and development for young people to be, emotionally aware, culturally diverse, and, just so when they, expose themselves to different people and different environments, they're able to be agile and adapt and be resilient to, the challenges that may lie ahead.
Thank you, Tia. Kate and Jennifer, I'd like to bring you in here with your reference, Jennifer, to market-specific plans and your own lived experience in Indonesia. Southeast Asia is one of the three key regions in this strategy, which will be a focus for the Western Australian government. What do you believe Western Australian businesses need to do? What are the top two or three things they need to do to capture opportunities with the Indonesian market?
Well, the opportunities are certainly there. I'll come back to the point around with markets, and Indonesia is one example, and I think it applies across a number of markets. And that is, again, really when you're going in and moving away from that sort of transactional approach where we say we've got something to sell, coming in and spending that time and having that commitment to understanding, again, what are those key drivers? What is the agenda? What are the priorities, both of government and industry, that we can plug into and align with to support that? Because that is far better received. Another really key point, I suppose, is around partnerships. And again, there's a really strong theme emerging out of the region around the importance of collaboration and partnerships. They're looking for partners. And the choice of the right partner in some of these markets, and particularly Indonesia, can actually help, mitigate some of the other potential challenges around cross-culture language that we've been referring to. They can actually help support that access into the market. And interestingly, the role of alumni, I've actually seen where we've had alumni educated in Australia and they go back overseas, they are again a great link back into the market. And some of the most successful joint ventures I saw in Indonesia were, in fact, joint ventures between Western Australian companies here and Indonesian companies that had a Australian alumni. So all the more reason then to probably position ourselves as a destination for education as well.
Terrific. And with the opportunities through ISIPA?
And ISIPA is absolutely. So ISIPA, and I'm sure Kate can comment on this as well, is a really, really important agreement. And a very important one in terms of the bilateral trade and economic relationship. It is quite deliberately termed as a Indonesia-Australia comprehensive economic partnership agreement as opposed to being just an FTA, so partnerships really underpin that. That, I think, presents some very specific opportunities for Western Australia, given our trade profile with Indonesia around agribusiness and food, mining and METS, vocational training. There are a number of quite important tariff reductions and non-tariff reductions that have been introduced as part of the ISIPA. So I think the job now is probably to support, certainly work alongside DFAT to promote those opportunities that will be available once it's ratified.
And those sectors you mentioned align nicely with the sectors of priority in the WA government's
they align
Asian
very
engagement
well.
Strategy.
Yeah.
Thank you. Kate, could I bring you in here to share your perspective around ISIPA, but also around the India Economic Strategy to 2035 and the opportunities it could present here for Western Australian businesses?
Yes, certainly. I think as some of you know, and we've got Phil Turtle here from the Australia-Indonesia Business Council, Gary Quinlan, our ambassador to Indonesia, was in Perth maybe a month ago, Phil, really to talk about the opportunities that this agreement, this partnership agreement, really provide for West Australians, you know, as Jenny, and we've talked about it a little bit already. I mean, it really is something that we're very hopeful that West Australians can really take full advantage of, and it is a really nice complementarity to the sectors that have been identified. And I'd say more broadly, the network of free trade agreements across the region is something that I think ensuring that West Australians have the opportunity, the information they need to be able to maximise their trade is a very important and core part of our work. I'll have a little plug, FTA portal, on the DFAT website. It's actually quite a user-friendly website for a government website, but really in being able to identify the goods and services that you are looking to trade and what free trade agreements are applicable and how you can benefit from those agreements. So I think that's really significant, and I think thank you for raising the India Economic Strategy, a report commissioned by the Australian Government and written by Peter Varghese, a former High Commissioner to India, as well as our former Secretary of DFAT. It's 300 pages, it's very detailed, and that's exactly what we needed. We needed a plan to be able to navigate what is obviously an extremely complicated and complex market, and how we can get some really good advice on which sectors and which states of India there are real opportunities for Australia to take forward. I would say, for me, that's a really important element here, which is that we know this, everybody here who's engaged with Asia knows this, but it's a very diverse region and everything is going to be different in each country. But India is a market in which engaging at a state level is very important and it can really deliver us results. So as it identifies its 10 key priority states, we really need to think about that. We know that one of those, Andhra Pradesh, is Western Australia's sister state. There are lots of opportunities as we take this engagement forward, which I know that Michael Carter, sitting over there from CCIWA, knows very well, given his previous role in India as well. So it's important.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Jennifer. We have a number of questions coming in from our wonderful audience. And the question with the maximum number of votes is about soft power and cultural diplomacy and engaging with Asia. It's a question to the panel, but perhaps first for Kate and for Jennifer. How can we support the creative industries in building a foundation for engagement with Asia?
I can go first. I think there's no question that soft power really helps build our influence in Asia. It's an end in itself, but it also underpins in a really significant, important way everything else we're trying to do. So I think we know, I think the core of the strategy as well as our white paper is about building connections. We know that whether it's cultural industries as well as sporting and other links, education, we know that this delivers results. How we support this, I think, is part of the challenge. I know DFAT, we're doing some work around how to take forward some of these initiatives. I'm pleased that there are some really good examples. The West Australian Ballet has been cooperating with Indonesia, and I'm really pleased that that's a really effective effort. We know that Screen West here in Western Australia is doing some really fantastic work in really developing partnerships in Indonesia that can take us forward and really provide a platform that we can build some further cooperation on. I think at this point it's probably fair to say I think a lot of those organisations are working themselves and making those commitments because they see where the future for their industries are. We know there's a lot of work with the China creative industry mm-hmm. sector that's developing. I think the challenge for government is beyond amplifying those messages, how do we maybe harness that and support it? Some of that is domestic policy too. How do we support those industries here in Western Australia?
Terrific. Thanks for sharing, Kate. Jennifer?
Just perhaps to put that also in another context too, I absolutely agree with everything Kate has said. I think there's a real power in cultural exchanges, sporting exchanges, youth exchanges, all those initiatives that really build those people-to-people links and those relationships. And we've seen that work very, very well in a sister state context, for example, between Western Australia and East Java, where over the past few years we've really worked to build up that sister state relationship, and it's been very much underpinned by exactly those things. So youth exchanges, a wonderful sporting exchange between Football West and Petasabaya football team in Surabaya, and James is open. And they, in fact, just come back from a trip to Surabaya. We're looking at some really interesting building on those cultural exchanges, and Minister Templeman was recently in Surabaya, and we're talking about a range of new collaboration in the creative industries space. But that work has been really, really important in building the relationships that have helped pave the way for trade and investment within the province as part of that sister state. So these soft power initiatives, this relationship building, does also support and pave the way for some more targeted trade and investment outcomes as well.
Well, thanks, Jennifer, and thank you, Kate. I encourage everyone to have a look at Creative Enterprises Australia. It's a national organisation, but what makes it unique is that it's got three investment funds investing in creative industry startups and taking them into Southeast Asia. So it's absolutely unique in that context. There isn't another organisation of its type in the country, and they're looking to grow their presence across the nation. So I encourage Western Australian creative industry enterprises to look at Creative Enterprises Australia. Another question from the audience is around Western Australian companies and their preparedness to engage with Asian markets and the types of capabilities that they need. Coming to you, Matthew, in terms of some of the programs that you believe would be helpful for businesses to participate and to be better prepared to go into Asian markets. And then perhaps, Jennifer, if I were to come to you, for you to share a little bit more about some of the programs that this strategy that the Minister also touched on is promising.
Thank you. Look, I think it's not one size fits all. At the corporate institutional end, there is that capability and building quite well in the state, and there seems to be good access into the various programs that are being offered. But I pick up on a point that Kate made, and I think probably for all of us that are in those sort of professional advisory services in the room, the lawyers, the bankers, the accountants, that there's a level of responsibility to actually be aware of what the programs are available to business so that we can then help our customers leverage those programs. And I think that's most particularly in the small, medium enterprise businesses that don't have that full, you know, that bottom end of that sort of corporate strata. They're the ones that are struggling. They don't have necessarily the bandwidth to develop it in-house. And they're the ones that are likely to be the best beneficiaries of, say, the Access Asia grants that were announced today. So, but they're often the ones that are not going to know about it unless they're told. And so I think, you know, it's a very much a case of getting the word out.
Thanks, Matt. Jennifer?
I think you make a very good point about SMEs. I think a lot of the opportunities that are emerging in the region are actually really well suited to sort of some of the niche products and services that SMEs can offer, and they are often the ones that do need that support. So as part of the strategy, of course, the Minister has announced the Access Asia Business Grants Fund. That's very much focused on providing support to SMEs in Western Australia. That's the key objective there, to provide a grant scheme to support their participation in trade missions, trade expos, to support them with marketing, development of marketing collateral, strategic planning, but also importantly building that Asia capability and literacy. So I think it's one of the first times we've had a grant scheme that actually provides an opportunity for that upskilling and building that capability. So the Access Asia Fund is certainly very important. We've talked about the market plans. That will also be very important in terms of supporting companies access markets. And also we are in the process of establishing Invest and Trade WA within the department, which will act as a front door for industry coming in. And we'll also support, through linking them up to our overseas network and the Commonwealth networks as well, will provide that additional support to Western Australian companies.
Thanks for sharing that, Jennifer. And for the benefit of everyone here who are keen to know, when does this program commence?
So the funding program, you will be able to actually access the information today. It will be on our website. The first round of grants will open on the 16th of September and be open for a couple of months. And so that's an opportunity for you to start to get familiarise yourselves with the guidelines and eligibility, and then look to start to lodge applications in time for the September round.
Terrific. Thanks for sharing that, Jennifer. Now, there are quite a few questions that have come and linked to international education, unsurprisingly, given that in the poll it was reflected together with tourism as being the two most popular sectors of really interest for the audience in this room. So I'm going to just bring together a couple of questions here, and I'm going to come to you, Thea, because I'm keen to hear from Kate and from Jennifer and from Matthew in terms of what the state can do to really grow its international student numbers. But I'd actually love to hear from you first, because you've actually been an international student, and I'd love to hear your opinion from your perspective as to what do you think this state can do to further incentivize international students to choose this state.
So I was only an international student by definition for a very brief amount of time, actually. My parents were very strategic enough to apply for a citizenship quite quickly. So I was fortunate to be considered West Australian when I was quite young. But I have, you know, throughout my life, you know, met many friends who are, you know, in university still, who are still international students. And I must say they are facing a little bit of limitations when it comes to career prospects here in WA. To couple international education and tourism, it usually starts off with, you know, tourism. You know, people get excited about Perth and they would come here, and then they see themselves actually living here, and they would start studying. And then obviously the next, you know, leapfrog down the pathway is to, you know, go find work. And during that transition between study and work, they do find a lot of great opportunities through funding, through scholarships to go on exchange to Asian countries. So I myself went to Beijing for 6 months of cultural and study exchange. And they found that that support was amazing. As a student, there was a lot of opportunities to immerse themselves in, you know, that scope of study, but also immerse themselves in an environment that is in Asia. And afterwards, you know, they tried to channel the skills that they've learned, you know, whether it be, you know, Chinese language or another Asian language, or the ability to play, you know, a traditional Asian musical instrument or something, to see if that could, you know, potentially give them an advantage when they submit their CVs in to find work. At the moment, they have felt that they don't see a great benefit towards these grants for study transitioning into work. They find that, you know, at the end of the day, there is still, you know, other aspects that would sort of, you know, consider them to be in the same playing field as other people who might not be proficient in Chinese or play a Chinese musical instrument. But they find that, you know, while they, you know, try as much as they can, at the end of the day, sometimes citizenship can get in, you know, the major factor in the way of getting them, you know, through the door, or even, you know, getting them considered by a human being in the HR department, instead of just being, you know, automatically filtered out by the computer system when they click, are you an Australian citizen, yes or no? So I think it would be, you know, sensational to see that, you know, a bigger support when supporting international students transitioning from studying to work life, because I have, you know, many international student friends who are very capable, very intellectual, and ready to, you know, represent West Australia with the skills that they have and work in the West Australian business areas. And it's just, you know, the little things that are just, you know, stopping them in the way.
So all things around the issues of employability of international students seems to be the key there. Jennifer, Kate, and Matthew, any comments as to what you feel government needs to do?
I would just say very quickly, not an expert in the field, but we know that education is Australia's third largest export. It's obviously critically important. Phil Payne from Study Perth is here, and I would just say, having spoken to him, I think the importance of tailoring efforts on the basis of really good evidence is pretty important. So really thinking and understanding the research that they've done about what motivates students to make decisions about where they study. You know, that organisation, supported by the state government, is making, I think, a really good contribution to bringing together the universities here in Western Australia and thinking about how to market this state. And it's on the basis of good evidence about what motivates students.
Terrific. Well, I am conscious of time, but it's been a terrific panel discussion from my perspective, because we've seen alignment here between the federal government and the state government, which is so crucial for a strategy like this to be implemented successfully. But we've also heard the voice of business, because Matthew has that direct business experience built over the last 30 years in seeing Western Australian businesses engage with a number of Asian markets. But we've also heard the voice of the future in Thea, who is going to deliver with others like Thea this great demographic dividend for this state so that we can engage more effectively. So with that, what I'd like to do is invite Paula Rogers to formally close this event.